He's on the Westland Bank paper. He read them in the order of publication. The first was just a brief that had run on page 3 of the Metro section. The information had apparently been gathered on the Tuesday the break-in was discovered. At the time, the LAPD and the FBI weren't that interested in talking to the press or letting the public know what had happened. Authorities probe bank break-in. An undisclosed amount of property was stolen from the Westland National Bank in downtown during the 3-day holiday weekend, authorities said Tuesday. The burglary, being investigated by the FBI and the Los Angeles Police Department, was discovered when managers of the bank located at the corner of Hill Street and 6th Avenue arrived Tuesday and found the safe deposit vault had been looted, FBI Special Agent John Rourke said. Rourke said an estimate on the loss of property had not been made, but sources close to the investigation said more than $1 million worth of jewels and other valuables stored in the vault by customers of the bank was taken. Rourke also declined to say how the burglars entered the vault, but did say that the alarm system was not working properly. He declined to elaborate. A spokesman for Westland declined Tuesday to discuss the burglary. Authorities said there were no arrests or suspects. Bosch wrote the name John Rourke in his notebook and went on to the next newspaper story, which was much longer. It had been published the day after the first and had been bannered across the top of the front page of the Metro section. It had a 2-deck headline and was accompanied by a photograph of a man and woman standing in the safe deposit vault looking down at a manhole-sized opening in the floor. Behind them was a pile of deposit boxes. Most of the small doors on the back wall were open. Bremer's byline was on the story. At least $2 million taken in bank tunnel job. Bandits had holiday weekend to dig into vault. The article expanded on the first story, filling in the detail that the perpetrators had tunneled into the bank, digging an approximately 150-yard line from a city storm main that ran under Hill Street. The story said an explosive device had been used to make the final break through the floor of the vault. According to the FBI, the burglars probably were in the vault through most of the holiday weekend, drilling open the individual safe deposit boxes. The entry tunnel from the stormwater main to the vault was believed to have been dug during 7 to 8 weeks before the heist. Bosch made a note to ask the FBI how the tunnel had been dug. If heavy equipment was used, most banks' alarms, which measured sound as well as earth vibrations, would have picked up the ground movement and sounded. Also, he wondered, why hadn't the explosive device set off alarms? He looked then at the third article, published the day after the second. This one wasn't written by Bremer, though it still had been played on the front of Metro. It was a feature on the dozens of people lining up at the bank to see if their safe deposit boxes were among those pried open and emptied. The FBI was escorting them into the vault and then taking their statements. Bosch scanned the story, but saw the same thing over and over again. People angry, or upset, or both, because they had lost items that they had placed in the vault because they believed it was safer than their homes. Near the bottom of the story, Harriet Beecham was mentioned. She had been interviewed as she came out of the bank, and she told a reporter she had lost a lifetime's collection of valuables bought while traveling the world with her late husband, Harry. The story said Beecham was dabbing at her eyes with a lace handkerchief. "I lost the rings he bought me in France, a bracelet of gold and jade from Mexico," Beecham said. "Whoever they were that did this, they took my memories." Very melodramatic. Bosch wondered if the last quote had been made up by the reporter. The fourth story in the file had been published a week later. By Bremer, it was short and had been buried in the back of Metro, behind where they stuffed the Valley News. Bremer reported that the Westland investigation was being handled exclusively by the FBI. The LAPD provided initial backup, but as leads dried up, the case was left in the Bureau's hands. Special Agent Rourke was quoted again in this story. He said agents were still on the case full-time, but no progress had been made or suspects identified. None of the property taken from the vault, he said, had turned up. Bosch closed the file. The case was too big for the Bureau to slough off like a bank stick-up. He wondered if Rourke had been telling the truth about the lack of suspects. He wondered if Meadows' name had ever come up. 2 decades earlier, Meadows had fought and sometimes lived in the tunnels beneath the villages of South Vietnam. Like all the tunnel fighters, he knew demolition work. But that was for bringing a tunnel down. Implosion. Could he have learned how to blow through the concrete and steel floor of a bank vault? Then Bosch realized that Meadows would not necessarily have needed to know how. He was sure the Westland job had taken more than one person. He got up and got another beer from the refrigerator. But before going back to the watch chair, he detoured into the bedroom, where he pulled an old scrapbook out of the bottom drawer of the bureau. Back in the chair, he drank down half the beer, then opened the book. There were bunches of photographs loose between the pages. He had meant to mount them, but had never gotten around to it. He rarely even opened the book. The pages were yellowed and had gone to brown at the edges. They were brittle, much like the memories the photos evoked. He picked up each snapshot and examined it, at some point realizing that he had never mounted them on the pages because he liked the idea of holding each picture in his hands, feeling it. The photographs were all taken in Vietnam. Like the picture found in Meadows' apartment, these were mostly in black and white. It was cheaper back then, getting black and white film developed in Saigon. Bosch was in some of the shots, but most were photos that he had taken with an old Leica his foster father had given him before he left. It was a peace gesture from the old man. He hadn't wanted Harry to go, and they had fought about it. So the camera was given and accepted. But Bosch was not one to tell stories when he returned, and the snapshots were left spread through the pages of the scrapbook, never to be mounted, rarely to be looked at. If there was a recurring theme of the photographs, it was the smiling faces and the tunnels. In almost every shot, there were soldiers standing in defiant poses at the mouth of a hole they had probably just been in and conquered. To the outsider, the photos would appear strange, maybe fascinating. But to Bosch, they were scary, like newspaper photos he had seen of people trapped in wrecked cars, waiting to be cut out by the firemen. The photos were of the smiling faces of young men who had dropped down into hell and come back to smile into the camera. Out of the blue and into the black is what they call going into a tunnel. Each one was a black echo. Nothing but death in there. But still, they went. Bosch turned a cracked page of the album and found Billy Meadows staring up at him. The photo had undoubtedly been taken a few minutes after the one Bosch had found at Meadows' apartment. The same group of soldiers, the same trench and tunnel. Echo Sector, Coochie District. But Bosch wasn't in this portrait because he had left the frame to snap the photo. His Leica had caught Meadows' vacant stare and stoned smile. His pale skin looked waxy but taut. He had captured the real Meadows, Bosch thought. He put the photo back in the page and turned to the next one. This one was of himself, no one else in the frame. He clearly remembered setting the camera down on a wooden table in a hooch and setting the timer. Then he moved into the frame. The camera had snapped as he was shirtless, the tattoo on his deeply tanned shoulder catching the falling sun through the window. Behind him, but out of focus, was the dark entrance to a tunnel lying uncovered on the straw floor of the hooch. The tunnel was blurred, forbidding darkness, like the ghastly mouth in Edvard Munch's painting, The Scream. It was a tunnel in the village they called Timbuktu, Bosch knew as he stared at the photo. His last tunnel. He was not smiling in the picture. His eyes were set in dark sockets. And neither was he smiling as he looked at it now. He held the photo in two hands, absent-mindedly rubbing his thumbs up and down the borders. He stared at the photograph until fatigue and alcohol pulled him down into sleepy thought, almost dreamlike. He remembered that last tunnel, and he remembered Billy Meadows. Three of them went in, two of them came out. The tunnel had been discovered during a routine sweep at a small village in E Sector. The village had no name on the recon maps, so the soldiers called it Timbuktu. The tunnels were turning up everywhere, so there weren't enough rats to go around. When the tunnel mouth was found under a rice basket in a hooch, the top sergeant didn't want to have to wait for a dust-off to land with fresh rats. He wanted to press on, but he knew he had to check the tunnel out. So the top made a decision like so many others in the war. He sent three of his own men in. Three virgins, scared as shit, maybe 6 weeks in country among them. The top told them not to go far, just set charges and come out. Do it fast and cover each other's ass. The three green soldiers dutifully went down into the hole. Except a half hour later, only two came out. The two who made it out said that the three of them had separated. The tunnel branched into several directions, and they split up. They were telling the top this when there was a rumble and a huge cough of noise and smoke and dust belched from the tunnel mouth. The C4 charges had detonated. The company Loot came in then and said they wouldn't leave the zone without the missing man. The whole company waited a day for the smoke and dust to settle in the tunnel, and then two tunnel rats were dropped during a dust-off, Harry Bosch and Billy Meadows. He didn't care if the missing soldier was dead, the lieutenant told him. Get him out. He wasn't going to leave one of his boys in that hole.
Go get him and bring him out here so we can get him a decent burial, the lieutenant said.
Meadows said, We wouldn't leave any of our own in there either. Bosch and Meadows went down the hole then and found that the main entry led to a junction room where baskets of rice were stored, and three other passageways began. Two of these had collapsed in the C4 explosions. The third was still open. It was the one the missing soldier had taken, and that was the way they went. They crawled through the darkness, Meadows in front, using their lights sparingly, until they reached a dead end. Meadows poked around the tunnel's dirt floor until he found the concealed door. He pried it open, and they dropped down into another level of the labyrinth. Without saying a word, Meadows pointed one way and crawled off. Bosch knew he would go the other way. Each would be alone now, unless the VC were waiting ahead. Bosch's way was a winding passage that was as warm as a steam bath. The tunnel smelled damp and faintly like a latrine. He smelled the missing soldier before he saw him. He was dead, his body putrefying, but sitting in the middle of the tunnel, with his legs straight out and spread, the toes of his boots pointing upward. His body was propped against a stake planted in the floor of the tunnel. A piece of wire that cut an inch into his neck was wrapped around the stake and held him in place. Afraid of a booby trap, Bosch didn't touch him. He played the beam of his flashlight over the neck wound and followed the trail of dried blood down the front of the body. The dead man wore a green T-shirt with his name stenciled in white on the front. Al Crofton, it said beneath the blood. There were flies mired in the crusted blood on his chest, and for a moment Bosch wondered how they found their way so far down. He dipped the light to the dead soldier's crotch and saw that it too was black with dried blood. The pants were torn open, and Crofton looked as though he had been mauled by a wild animal. Sweat began to sting Bosch's eyes, and his breathing became louder, more hurried than he wanted it to be. He was immediately aware of this, but was also aware that he could do nothing to stop it. Crofton's left hand was palm up on the ground next to his thigh. Bosch put the light on it and saw the bloody set of testicles. He stifled the urge to vomit, but could not prevent himself from hyperventilating. He cupped his hands over his mouth and tried to slow his gasping for air. It didn't work. He was losing it. He was panicking. He was 20 years old, and he was scared. The walls of the tunnel were closing tighter on him. He rolled away from the body and dropped the light, its beam still focused on Crofton. Bosch kicked at the clay walls of the tunnel and curled into a fetal position. The sweat in his eyes was replaced by tears. At first they came silently, but soon his sobs racked his entire body and his noise seemed to echo in all directions in the darkness, right to where Charlie sat and waited. Right to hell. Part 2. Monday, May 21st. Bosch came awake in his watch chair about 4 a.m. He had left the sliding glass door open to the porch, and the Santa Ana winds were billowing the curtains, ghost-like, out across the room. The warm wind and the dream had made him sweat. Then the wind had dried the moisture on his skin like a salty shell. He stepped out onto the porch and leaned against the wood railing, looking down at the lights of the valley. The searchlights at Universal were long since retired for the night, and there was no traffic sound from the freeway down in the pass. In the distance, maybe from Glendale, he heard the whooping sound of a helicopter. He searched and found the red light moving low in the basin. It wasn't circling, and there was no searchlight. It wasn't a cop. He thought then that he could smell the slight scent of malathion, sharp and bitter on the red wind. He went back inside and closed the sliding glass door. He thought about bed, but knew there would be no more sleep this night. It was often this way with Bosch. Sleep would come early in the night, but not last. Or it would not come until the arriving sun softly cut the outline of the hills in the morning fog. He had been to the sleep disorder clinic at the VA in Sepulveda, but the shrinks couldn't help him. They told him he was in a cycle. He would have extended periods of deep sleep trances into which torturous dreams invaded. This would be followed by months of insomnia, the mind reacting defensively to the terrors that awaited in sleep. "Your mind has repressed the anxiety you feel over your part in the war," the doctor told him. "You must assuage these feelings in your waking hours before your sleep time can progress undisturbed." But the doctor didn't understand that what was done was done. There was no going back to repair what had happened. You can't patch a wounded soul with a Band-Aid. He showered and shaved, afterwards studying his face in the mirror and remembering how unkind time had been to Billy Meadows. Bosch's hair was turning to gray, but it was full and curly. Other than the circles under his eyes, his face was unlined and handsome. He wiped the remaining shaving cream off and put on his beige summer suit with a light blue button-down Oxford. On a hanger in the closet, he found a maroon tie with little gladiator helmets on it that was not unreasonably wrinkled or stained. He pegged it in place with the 187 tie pin, clipped his gun to his belt, and then headed out into the pre-dawn dark. He drove into downtown for an omelet, toast, and coffee at the pantry on Figueroa. Open 24 hours a day since before the Depression. A sign boasted that the place had not gone 1 minute in that time without a customer. Bosch looked around from the corner and saw that at the moment he was personally carrying the record on his shoulders. He was alone. The coffee and cigarettes got Bosch ready for the day. After, he took the freeway back up to Hollywood, passing a frozen sea of cars already fighting to get downtown. Hollywood Station was on Wilcox, just a couple of blocks south of the boulevard where most of its business came from. He parked at the curb out front because he was only staying a while and didn't want to get caught in the backlot traffic jam at the change of watch. As he walked through the small lobby, he saw a woman with a blackened eye who was crying and filling out a report with the desk officer. But down the hall to the left, the detective bureau was quiet. The night man must have been out on a call or up in the bridal suite, a storage room on the second floor where there were two cots, first come, first served. The detective bureau's hustle and bustle seemed to be frozen in place. No one was there, but the long tables assigned to burglary, auto, juvenile, robbery, and homicide were all awash in paperwork and clutter. The detectives came and went. The paper never changed. Bosch went to the back of the bureau to start a pot of coffee. He glanced through a rear door and down the back hallway where the lockup benches and the jail were located. Halfway down the hall to the holding tank, a young white boy with blonde dreadlocks sat handcuffed to a bench. A juvie, maybe 17 at most, Bosch figured. It was against California law to put them in a holding tank with adults, which was like saying it might be dangerous for coyotes to be put in a pen with Dobermans.
"What are you looking at, fuckhead?"
the boy called down the hall to Bosch. Bosch didn't say anything. He dumped a bag of coffee into a paper filter. A uniform stuck his head out of the watch commander's office farther down the hall.
"I told you!" the uniform yelled at the kid. "Once more and I'm going to go up a notch on the cuffs. Half hour you won't feel your hands. Then how are you going to wipe your ass into John?"
"I guess I'll have to use your fucking face."
The uniform stepped into the hall and headed toward the kid, his hard black shoes making long, mean strides. Bosch shoved the filter bowl into the coffee machine and hit the brewing cycle switch. He walked away from the hallway door and over to the homicide table. He didn't want to see what happened with the kid. He dragged his chair away from his spot at the table and over to one of the community typewriters. The pertinent forms he needed were in slots on a rack on the wall above the machine. He rolled a blank crime scene report into the typewriter. Then he took his notebook out of his pocket and opened the first page. 2 hours of typing and smoking and drinking bad coffee later, a bluish cloud hung near the ceiling lights over the homicide table, and Bosch had completed the myriad forms that accompany a homicide investigation. He got up and made copies on the Xerox in the back hall. He noticed the dreadlock kid was gone. Then he got a new blue binder out of the office supplies closet, after finessing the door with his LAPD ID card, and hooked one set of the typed reports onto the three rings. The other set he hid in an old blue binder he kept in a file drawer, and that was labeled with the name of an old, unsolved case. When he was done, he reread his work. He liked the order the paperwork gave the case. On many previous cases, he had made it a practice to reread the murder book each morning. It helped him draw out theories. The smell of the binder's new plastic reminded him of other cases and invigorated him. He was in the hunt again. The reports he had typed and placed in the murder book were not complete, though. On the investigating officer's chronological report, he had left out several parts of his Sunday afternoon and evening. He neglected to type in the connection he had made between Meadows and the Westland Bank burglary. He also left out the visits to the pawn shop and to see Bremer at the Times. There were no typed summaries of these interviews either. It was only Monday, day two. He wanted to wait until he had been to the FBI before committing any of that information to the official record. He wanted to know exactly what was going on first. It was a precaution he took on every case. He left the bureau before any of the other detectives had arrived for the day. By nine, Bosch had driven to Westwood and was on the 17th floor of the Federal Building on Wilshire Boulevard. The FBI waiting room was austere. The usual plastic-covered couches and scarred coffee table with old copies of the FBI bulletin fanned across its fake wood-grain veneer. Bosch didn't bother to sit down or read. He stood before the sheer white curtains that covered the floor-to-ceiling windows and looked out at the panorama. The northern exposure offered a view that stretched from the Pacific eastward around the rim of the Santa Monica Mountains to Hollywood. The curtains served as a layer of fog over the smog. He stood with his nose almost touching the soft gauze fabric and looked down across Wilshire at the Veterans Administration Cemetery. Its white stones sprouted in the manicured grass like row after row of baby teeth. Near the cemetery's entrance, a funeral was in progress, with a full honor guard at attention. But there wasn't much of a crowd of mourners. Farther north, at the top of a rise where there were no tombstones, Bosch could see several workers removing sod and using a backhoe to dig up a long slice of the earth. He checked their progress from time to time as he scanned the view, but he could not figure out what they were doing. The clearing was far too long and wide for a grave. By 10:30, the soldier's funeral was done, but the cemetery workers were still toiling on the hill. And Bosch was still waiting at the curtain. A voice finally hit him from behind.
All those graves, such neat rows. I try never to look out the windows here.
He turned. She was tall and lithesome, with brown, wavy hair about to the shoulder with blonde highlights, a nice tan and little makeup. She looked hard-shell, and maybe a little weary for so early in the day, the way lady cops and hookers get. She wore a brown business suit and a white blouse with a chocolate-brown western bow. He detected the unsymmetrical curves of her hips beneath the jacket. She was carrying something small on the left side, maybe a Ruger, which was unusual. Bosch had always known female detectives to carry their weapons in their purses.
"That's the Veterans Cemetery," she said to him.
"I know." He smiled, but not at that. It was that he had expected Special Agent E.D. Wish to be a man. No reason other than that was what most of the Bureau agents assigned to the bank detail were. Women were part of the newer image of the Bureau, and weren't usually found in the heavy squads. It was a fraternity largely made up of dinosaurs and cast-outs, guys who couldn't or wouldn't cut it in the Bureau's hard-charging focus on white-collar espionage and drug investigations. The days of Melvin Purvis, G-Man, were just about over. Bank robbery wasn't flashy anymore. Most bank robbers weren't professional thieves. They were hypes looking for a score that would keep them going for a week. Of course, stealing from a bank was still a federal crime. That was the only reason the Bureau still bothered.
"Of course," she said. "You must know that. How can I help you, Detective Bosch? I'm Agent Wish."
They shook hands, but Wish made no movement toward the door she had come through. It had closed, and the lock had snapped home. Bosch hesitated a moment and then said,
"Well, I've been waiting all morning to see you. It's about the bank squad. One of your cases?"
"Yes, that's what you told the receptionist. Sorry to have kept you, but we had no appointment, and I had another pressing matter. I wish you had called first."
Bosch nodded his understanding, but again there was no movement toward inviting him in. This isn't working right, he thought.
"Do you have any coffee back there?" he said.
"Yes, I believe we do. But can we make this quick? I'm really in the middle of something at the moment."
Who isn't? Bosch thought. She used a card key to open the door and then pulled it open and held it for him. Inside, she led him down a corridor where there were plastic signs on the walls next to the doors. The Bureau didn't have the same affinity for acronyms as the police department. The signs were numbered, Group 1, Group 2, and so on. As they went along, he tried to replace her accent. It had been slightly nasal, but not like New York. Philadelphia, he decided. Maybe New Jersey. Definitely not Southern California. Never mind the tan that went with it.
Black,
she said. Cream and sugar, please. She turned and entered a room that was furnished as a small kitchen. There was a counter and cabinets, a coffee maker, a microwave, and a refrigerator. The place reminded Bosch of law offices he had been to give depositions. Nice, neat, expensive. She handed him a styrofoam cup of black coffee and signaled for him to put in his own cream and sugar. She wasn't having any. If it was an attempt to make him uncomfortable, it worked. Bosch felt like an imposition, not someone who brought good news, a break in a big case. He followed her back into the hallway, and they went through the next doorway, which was marked Group 3. It was the bank robbery kidnap unit. The room was about the size of a convenience store. It was the first federal squad room Bosch had been in, and the comparison to his own office was depressing. The furniture here was newer than anything he had ever seen in any LAPD squad. There was actually carpet on the floor, and a typewriter or computer at almost every desk. There were three rows of five desks, and all of them but one were empty. A man in a gray suit sat at the first desk in the middle row, holding a phone to his ear. He didn't look up as Bosch and Wish walked in. Except for the background noise of a tactical channel coming from a scanner on a file cabinet in the back, the place could have passed for a real estate office. Wish took a seat behind the first desk in the first row and gestured for Bosch to take the seat alongside it. This put him directly between Wish and Gray Suit on the phone. Bosch put his coffee down on her desk and began to figure right away that Gray Suit wasn't really on the phone, even though the guy kept saying, or uh-uh, every few moments or so. Wish opened a file drawer in her desk and pulled out a plastic bottle of water, some of which she poured into a paper cup.
We had a 211, had a savings and loan in Santa Monica. Just about everybody's out on it, she explained as he scanned the almost empty room. I was coordinating from here. That's why you had to wait out there. Sorry.
No problem. Get him?
What makes you say it was a him?
Bosch shrugged his shoulders. Percentages?
Well, it was two of them, one of each. And yes, we got them. They were in a stolen from Reseda reported yesterday. Female went in and took care of business. Male was the wheel. They took the 10 to the 405, then into LAX, where they left the car in front of the Skycap at United. Then they took the escalator to the arrivals level, got on a shuttle bus to the flyaway station in Van Nuys, and then took a cab all the way back down to Venice, to a bank. We had an LAPD copter over them the whole time. They never looked up. When she went into the second bank, we thought we were going to see another 211, so we rushed her while she was waiting in line for a teller. Got him in the parking lot. Turned out she was going to deposit the take from the first bank, an interbank transfer, the hard way. See some dumb people in this business, Detective Bosch. What can I do for you?
You can call me Harry.
As I am doing what for you?
Interdepartmental cooperation, he said. Kind of like you and our helicopter this morning. Bosch drank some of his coffee and said, Your name is on a bolo I came across yesterday. Your old case out of downtown. I'm interested in it. I work homicide out of Hollywood
Yes, I know,
Agent Wish interrupted. Vision.
The receptionist showed me the card you gave. By the way, do you need it back?
That was a cheap shot. He saw his sad-looking business card on her clean, green blotter. It had been in his wallet for months, and its corners were curled up at the edges. It was one of the generic cards the department gave detectives who worked out in the bureaus. It had the embossed police badge on it and the Hollywood Division phone number, but no name. You could buy yourself an ink pad and order a stamp and sit at your desk at the beginning of each week and stamp out a couple of dozen cards, or you could just write your name on the line with a pen and not give out too many. Bosch had done the latter. Nothing the department could do could embarrass him anymore.
No, you can keep it.
By the way, you have one? In a quick, impatient motion, she opened the top middle drawer of the desk, took a card out of a little tray and put it down on the desktop, next to the elbow Bosch had leaned there. He took another sip of coffee while glancing down at it. The E stood for Eleanor. "So, anyway, you know who I am and where I come from," he began. "And I know a little about you. For instance, you investigated, or are investigating, a bank caper from last year in which the perps came in through the ground. A tunnel job, Westland National." He noticed her attention immediately pick up with that, and even thought he sensed Graysuit's breathing catch. Bosch had a line in the right water. "Your name is on the bulletins. I'm investigating a homicide I believe is related to your case, and I want to know... Basically, I want to know what you've got. Can we talk about suspects, possible suspects? I think we might be looking for the same people. I think my guy might have been one of your perps." Wish was quiet for a moment and played with a pencil she'd picked up off the blotter. She pushed Bosch's card around on the green square with the eraser end. Graysuit was still acting like he was on the phone. Bosch glanced over at him and their eyes briefly connected. Bosch nodded and Graysuit looked away. Bosch figured he was looking at the man whose comments had been in the newspaper articles, Special Agent John Rourke.
"You can do better than that, can't you, Detective Bosch?"
Wish said.
"I mean, you just walk in here and wave the flag of cooperation and you expect me to just open up our files?"
She tapped the pencil three times on the desk and shook her head like she was disciplining a child.
"How about a name?" she said. "How about giving me some reason for the connection? We usually handle this kind of request through channels. We have liaisons that evaluate requests from other law enforcement agencies to share files and information. You know that. I think it might be best..."
Bosch pulled the FBI bulletin with the insurance photo of the bracelet out of his pocket. He unfolded it and laid it on the blotter. Then he took the pawn shop Polaroid out of the other pocket and also dropped that on the desk. "Westland National," he said, tapping a finger on the bulletin. "The bracelet was pawned 6 weeks ago in a downtown shop. My guy pawned it. Now he's dead." She kept her eyes on the Polaroid bracelet, and Bosch saw recognition there. The case had stayed that much with her. "The name is William Meadows. Found him in a pipe yesterday morning up at the Mulholland Dam." Graysuit ended his one-sided conversation. He said,
"I appreciate the information. I have to go. We're wrapping up at 2:11. Uh-huh. Thank you. Yeah, you too. Goodbye now."
Bosch didn't look at him. He watched Wish. He thought he sensed that she wanted to look over at Graysuit. Her eyes darted that way, but then quickly went back to the photograph. Something wasn't right, and Bosch decided to jump back into the silence. "Why don't we skip the bullshit, Agent Wish? As far as I can tell, you've never recovered a single stock certificate, a single coin, a single jewel, a single gold and jade bracelet. You've got nothing. So screw the liaison stuff. I mean, what is this? My guy pawned the bracelet. He ended up dead. Why? We have parallel investigations here, don't you think? More likely, the same investigation." Nothing. "My guy was either given that bracelet by your perps, or he stole it from them, or possibly he was one of them. So maybe the bracelet wasn't supposed to turn up yet. Nothing else has. And he goes and breaks the rules and pawns the thing. They whack him, then go to the pawn shop and steal it back. Whatever. The thing is, we are looking for the same people, and I need a direction to start in." She remained silent still, but Bosch sensed the decision coming. This time he waited her out.
"Tell me about him," she finally said.
He told her about the anonymous call, about the body, about the apartment that had been searched, about finding the pawn stub hidden behind the photo, and then going to the pawn shop to find the bracelet stolen. He didn't say that he had known Meadows.
"Anything else taken from the pawn shop, or just this bracelet?" she asked when he was done.
"Of course, yes. But just as a cover for the real thing they wanted, the bracelet. Way I see it, Meadows was killed because whoever killed him wanted the bracelet. He was tortured before he was murdered because they wanted to know where it was. They got what they needed, killed him, then went and got the bracelet. Mind if I smoke?"
"Yes, I do. What could be so important about one bracelet? This bracelet is only a drop in the bucket of what was taken, or what hasn't ever turned up."
Bosch had thought of that and didn't have an answer. He said, I don't know.
If he was tortured, as you say, why was the pawn ticket there for you to find? And why did they have to break into the pawn shop? You're suggesting that he told them where the bracelet was but didn't give up the ticket?
Basha thought about this, too, he said. I don't know. Maybe he knew they wouldn't let him live, so he only gave them half of what they needed. He kept something back. It was a clue. He left the pawn stub behind as a clue. Bosch thought about the scenario. He had first begun to put it together when rereading his notes and the reports he had typed. He decided it was time to play one more card. I knew Meadows 20 years ago.
You knew this victim, Detective Bosch?
Her voice was louder now, accusatory.
Why didn't you say that when you first came in here? Since when does the LAPD allow its detectives to go around investigating the deaths of their friends?
I didn't say that. I said I knew him 20 years ago. And I didn't ask for the case. It was my turn in the bucket. I got the call out. It was, he didn't want to say, coincidence.
This is all very interesting,
Wish said. It is also irregular. I'm not sure we can help you. I think, look, when I knew him, it was with the U.S. Army, 1st Infantry in Vietnam, okay? We were both there. He was what they called a tunnel rat. Do you know what that means? I was one, too. Wish said nothing. She was looking down at the bracelet again. Bosch had totally forgotten about gray suit. The Vietnamese had tunnels under their villages, Bosch said. Some were a century old. The tunnels went from hooch to hooch, village to village, jungle to jungle. They were under some of our own camps, everywhere. And that was our job, the tunnel soldiers, to go down into those things. There was a whole other war under the ground. Bosch realized that aside from a shrink and a circle group at the VA in Sepulveda, he had never told anyone about the tunnels and what he did. And Meadows, he was good at it. As much as you could like going down into that blackness with just a flashlight and a .45, well, he did. Sometimes we'd go down and it would take hours, and sometimes it would take days. And Meadows, well, he was the only one I ever knew over there that wasn't scared of going down there. It was life above ground that scared him. She didn't say anything. Bosch looked over at Gray Suit, who was writing on a yellow tablet Bosch couldn't read. Bosch heard someone report on the TAC channel that he was transporting two prisoners to the metro lockup. So now, 20 years later, you've got a tunnel caper, and I've got a dead tunnel fighter. He was found in a pipe, a tunnel. He had property from your caper. Bosch felt around in his pockets for his cigarettes, then remembered she had said no. We have to work together on this one, right now. He knew by her face it hadn't worked. He emptied his coffee cup, ready for the door. He didn't look at Wish now. He heard Gray Suit pick up the phone again and punch a number out. He stared down at the residue of sugar in the bottom of his cup. He hated sugar in his coffee.
Detective Bosch, Wish began, I am sorry you had to wait in the hall so long this morning. I am sorry this fellow soldier you knew, Meadows, is dead. Whether it was 20 years ago or not, I am. I have sympathy for him and you and what you may have had to go through. But I am also sorry that I can't help you at the moment. I will have to follow established protocol and talk to my supervisor. I will get back to you as soon as possible. That is all I can do at the moment.
Bosch dropped the cup into a trash can next to her desk and reached over to pick up the Polaroid and the bulletin page.
Can we keep the photo here? Agent Wish asked. I need to show it to my supervisor.
Bosch kept the Polaroid. He got up and stepped in front of Gray Suit's desk. He held the Polaroid up to the man's face. He's seen it, he said over his shoulder as he walked out of the office. Deputy Chief Irvin Irving sat at his desk, bruxing his teeth and working the muscles of his jaw into hard rubber balls. He was disturbed, and this clenching and gnashing of teeth was his habit when disturbed or in solitary contemplative moods. As a result, the musculature of his jaw had become the most pronounced feature of his face. When looked at head-on, Irving's jawline was actually wider than his ears, which were pinned flat against his shaven skull and had a wing-like shape to them. The ears and the jaw gave Irving an intimidating, if not odd, visage. He looked like a flying jaw, as though his powerful molars could crush marbles, and Irving did all he could to promote this image of himself as a fearsome, junkyard dog who might sink his teeth into a shoulder or leg and tear out a piece of meat the size of a softball. It was an image that had helped overcome his one impediment as a Los Angeles policeman, his silly name, and could only aid him in his long-planned ascendancy to the chief's office on the 6th floor. So he indulged the habit even if it did cost him a new set of $2,000 molar implants every 18 months. Irving pulled his tie tight against his throat and ran his hand over his gleaming scalp. He reached to the intercom buzzer. Though he could have easily pushed the speaker button then and barked his command, he waited for his new adjutant's reply first. This was another of his habits.
Yes, Chief?
He loved hearing that. He smiled, then leaned forward until his great, wide jaw was inches from the intercom speaker. He was a man who did not trust that technology could do what it was supposed to do. He had to put his mouth to the speaker and shout. Mary, get me the jacket on Harry Bosch. It should be in the actives. He spelled the first and last names for her.
Right away, Chief.
Irving leaned back, smiled through clenched teeth, but then thought he felt something out of alignment. He deftly ran his tongue over his left rear lower molar, searching for a defect in its smooth surface, maybe a slight fissure. Nothing. He opened the desk drawer and took out a small mirror. He opened his mouth and studied the back teeth. He put the mirror back and took out a pale blue Post-it pad and made a note to call for a dental checkup. He closed the drawer and remembered the time he had popped a fortune cookie into his mouth while dining with the city councilman from the west side. The right rear lower molar had crumbled on the stale cookie. The junkyard dog decided to swallow the dental debris rather than expose the weakness to the councilman, whose confirmation vote he would someday need and expect. During the meal, he had brought to the councilman's attention the fact that his nephew, and LAPD motorman, was a closet homosexual. Irving mentioned that he was doing his best to protect the nephew and prevent his exposure. The department was as homophobic as a Nebraska church, and if the word leaked to the rank and file, Irving explained to the councilman, the officer could forget any hope for advancement. He could also expect brutal harassment from the rest of LA's finest. Irving didn't need to mention the consequences if a scandal broke publicly. Even on the liberal West Side, it wouldn't help a councilman's mayoral ambitions. Irving was smiling at the memory when Officer Mary Grosso knocked and then walked into the office with a 1-inch-thick file in her hand. She placed it on Irving's glass-topped desk. There was nothing else on its gleaming surface, not even a phone.
You were right, Chief. It was still in the actives files.
The deputy chief in charge of the Internal Affairs Division leaned forward and said, Yes, I believe I did not have it transferred to archives because I had a feeling we had not seen the last of Detective Bosch. Let me see, that would be Lewis and Clark, I believe. He opened the file and read the notations on the inside of the jacket. Yes. Mary, will you have Lewis and Clark come in, please?
Chief, I saw them in the squad. They were getting ready for a BOR, I'm not sure which case.
Well, Mary, they will have to cancel the Board of Rights, and please do not talk to me in abbreviations. I am a slow-moving, careful policeman. I do not like shortcuts. I do not like abbreviations. You will learn that. Now, tell Lewis and Clark I want them to delay the hearing and report to me forthwith.
He flexed his jaw muscles and held them, hard as tennis balls, at their full width. Grosso scurried from the office. Irving relaxed and paged through the file, reacquainting himself with Harry Bosch. He noted Bosch's military record and his fast advance through the department, from patrol to detectives to the elite robbery homicide division in 8 years. Then the fall. Administrative transfer last year from robbery homicide to Hollywood homicide. Should have been fired, Irving lamented as he studied the entries on Bosch's career chronology. Next, Irving scanned the evaluation report on a psychological given Bosch the year before to determine if he should be allowed to return to duty after killing an unarmed man. The department psychologist wrote, Through his war and police experiences, most notably including the aforementioned shooting resulting in fatality, the subject has to a high degree become desensitized to violence. He speaks in terms of violence or the aspect of violence being an accepted part of his day-to-day life for all of his life. Therefore, it is unlikely that what transpired previously will act as a psychological deterrent should he again be placed in circumstances where he must act with deadly force in order to protect himself or others. I believe he will be able to act without delay. He will be able to pull the trigger. In fact, his conversation reveals no ill effects at all from the shooting, unless his sense of satisfaction with the outcome of the incident, the suspect's death, should be deemed inappropriate. Irving closed the file and tapped it with a manicured nail. He then picked a strand of long, brown hair. Officer Mary Grosso's, he presumed, off the glass desktop and dropped it into a wastebasket next to the desk. Harry Bosch was a problem, he thought. A good cop, a good detective. Actually, Irving grudgingly admired his homicide work, particularly his affinity for serial slayers. But in the long run, the deputy chief believed, outsiders did not work well inside the system. Harry Bosch was an outsider, always would be, not part of the LAPD family. And now the worst had come to Irving's attention. Bosch had not only left the family, but appeared to be engaged in activities that would hurt the family, embarrass the family. Irving decided that he would have to move swiftly and surely. He swiveled in his chair and looked out the window at City Hall, across Los Angeles Street. Then his gaze dropped, as it always did, to the marble fountain in front of Parker Center, the memorial to officers killed in the line of duty. There was family, he thought. There was honor. He clenched his teeth powerfully, triumphantly. Just then, the door opened. Detectives Pierce Lewis and Don Clark strode into the office and presented themselves. Neither spoke. They could have been brothers. They shared close-cropped brown hair, the arm-splayed build of weightlifters, conservative gray silk suits. Lewis's had a thin charcoal stripe, Clark's maroon. Each man was built wide and low to the ground for better handling. Each had a slightly forward tilt to his body, as if he were wading out to sea, crashing through breakers with his face. "Gentlemen," said Irving, "we have a problem, a priority problem, with an officer who has come across our threshold before, an officer you two worked with some degree of success before." Lewis and Clark glanced at each other, and Clark allowed himself a small, quick smile. He couldn't guess who it could be, but he liked going after repeaters. They were so desperate.
"Harry Bosch," Irving said.
He waited a moment to let the name sink in, then said,
"You need to take a little ride up to Hollywood Division. I want to open a 1.81 on him right away. Complainant will be the Federal Bureau of Investigation."
"FBI?"
Lewis said.
"What did he do with them?"
Irving corrected him for using the abbreviation for the Bureau and told them to sit down in the two chairs in front of his desk. He spent the next 10 minutes recounting the telephone call he had received minutes earlier from the Bureau.
"The Bureau says it is too coincidental," he concluded. "I concur. He may be dirty in this, and the Bureau wants him off the Meadows case. At the very least, it appears he intervened to help this suspect, his former military comrade, avoid a jail term last year, possibly so he could accomplish this bank burglary. Whether Bosch knew this, or if there was further involvement in the crime, I do not know. But we are going to find out what Detective Bosch is up to."
Irving delayed here to drive home his point with a full jaw flex. Lewis and Clark knew better than to interrupt. Irving then said,
"This opportunity opens the door for the department to do what it was unable to accomplish before with Bosch. Eliminate him. You will report directly to me. Oh, and I want Bosch's supervisor, a Lieutenant Pounds, copied with your daily reports. On the quiet. But you will do more than copy me. I want telephonic reports twice daily, morning and evening."
"We're on our way," Lewis said as he stood up.
"Aim high, gentlemen, but be careful," Irving counseled them. "Detective Harry Bosch is no longer the celebrity he once was, but nevertheless, do not let him slip away."
Bosch's embarrassment at being unceremoniously dismissed by Agent Wish had turned to anger and frustration as he rode down the elevator. It was like a physical presence in his chest that jumped into his throat as the stainless steel cell descended. He was alone, and when the pager on his belt started to chirp, he let it go on for its allotted 15 seconds rather than turn it off. He swallowed his anger and embarrassment and formed it into resolve. As he stepped out of the elevator car, he looked down at the phone number on the pager's digital display. An 818 area code. The Valley, but he didn't recognize the number. He stepped to a pod of payphones in the courtyard in front of the federal building and dialed the number. 90 cents, an electronic voice said. Luckily, he had the loose change. He dumped it in and the call was picked up on a half ring by Jerry Edgar.
"Harry,"
he began without a hello.
"I'm still up here at the VA and I'm getting the runaround, man. They don't have any files on Meadows. They say I have to go through D.C. or I got to get a warrant. I tell them, I know there is a file, you know, on account of what you told me. I say, look, if I was to get a search warrant, can you look and make sure you know where this file is? And so they're looking for a while, and what they finally come out saying is, yes, they had a file, but it's gone. Guess who came and got it with a court order last year?
The FBI.
You know something I don't know?
I haven't exactly been sitting on my ass. They say when the Bureau took it, or why?
They weren't told why. FBI agent just came in with the warrant and took it. Checked it out last September and hasn't brought it back since. Didn't give a reason. The fucking BI doesn't have to.
Bosch was quiet while he thought about this. They knew all along. Wish knew about Meadows and the tunnels and everything else he had just told her. It had all been a show.
Harry, you there?
Yeah, listen. Did they show you a copy of the paperwork or know the name of the agent?
Nah, they couldn't find the subpoena receipt, and nobody remembered the agent's name, except that she was a woman.
Take this number where I'm at. Go back to them in records and ask for another file. Just see if it's there. My file. He gave Edgar the payphone number, his date of birth, social security number, and his full name, spelling out his real first name.
Jesus! That's your first name? Harry, for short. Woo! How'd your mama come up with that one?
She had a thing about 15th-century painters. It goes with the last name. Go check on the file and call me back. I'll wait here.
I can't even pronounce it, man.
Rhymes with anonymous.
Okay, I'll try that. Where you at, anyway?
A payphone outside the FBI. Bosch hung up before his partner could ask any questions. He lit a cigarette and leaned on the phone booth while watching a small group of people walking in a circle on the long green lawn in front of the building. They were holding up homemade signs and placards that protested a proposal to open new oil leases in Santa Monica Bay. He saw signs that said, "Just say no to oil," and "Isn't the bay polluted enough?" and "United States of Exxon," and so on. He noticed a couple of TV news crews on the lawn filming the protest. That was the key, he thought. Exposure. As long as the media showed up and put it on the 6 o'clock news, the protest was a success. A soundbite success. Bosch noticed that the group's apparent spokesman was being interviewed on camera by a woman he recognized from Channel 4. He also recognized the spokesman, but he wasn't sure from where. After a few moments of watching the man's ease during the interview in front of the camera, Bosch placed him. The guy was a TV actor who used to play a drunk on a popular situation comedy that Bosch had seen once or twice. Though the guy still looked like a drunk, the show wasn't on anymore. Bosch was on his second cigarette, leaning on the phone booth and beginning to feel the heat of the day, when he looked up at the glass doors of the building and saw Agent Eleanor Wish walking through. She was looking down and digging a hand through her purse and hadn't noticed him. Quickly, and without analyzing why, he ducked behind the phones and, using them as a shield, moved around them as she walked by. It was sunglasses she had been looking for in the purse. Now she had them on as she walked past the protesters without even a glance in their direction. She headed up Veteran Avenue to Wilshire Boulevard. Bosch knew the federal garage was under the building. Wish was walking in the opposite direction. She was going somewhere nearby. The phone rang.
Harry, they have your file, too. The FBI. What's going on?
Edgar's voice was urgent and confused. He didn't like waves. He didn't like mysteries. He was a straight 9-to-5 man. I don't know what's going on. They wouldn't tell me, Bosch replied. You head into the office. We'll talk there. If you get there before me, I want you to make a call over to the subway project. Personnel. See if they had Meadows working there. Try under the name Fields, too. Then just do the paper on the TV stabbing, like we said. Keep your end of our deal. I'll meet you there.
Harry, you told me you knew this guy, Meadows. Maybe we should tell 98 it's a conflict, that we ought to turn the case over to RHD or somebody else on the table.
We'll talk about it in a little while, Jed. Don't do anything or talk to anybody about it till I get there. Bosch hung up the phone and walked off toward Wilshire. He could see Wish already had turned east toward Westwood Village. He closed the distance between them, crossed to the other side of the street, and followed behind. He was careful not to get too close, so that his reflection would not be in the shop windows she was looking in as she walked. When she reached Westwood Boulevard, she turned north and crossed Wilshire, coming to Bosch's side of the street. He ducked into a bank lobby. After a few moments, he went back out on the sidewalk, and she was gone. He looked both ways and then trotted up to the corner. He saw her a half block up Westwood, going into the village. Wish slowed in front of some shop windows and came to a stop in front of a sporting goods store. Bosch could see female mannequins in the window, dressed in lime green running shorts and shirts. Last year's fad, on sale today. Wish looked at the outfits for a few moments and then headed off, not stopping until she was in the theater district. She turned into Stratton's Bar and Grill. Bosch, on the other side of the street, passed the restaurant without looking and went up to the next corner. He stood in front of the Bruin, below the old theater's marquee, and looked back. She hadn't come out. He wondered if there was a rear door. He looked at his watch. It was a little early for lunch, but maybe she liked to beat the crowd. Maybe she liked to eat alone. He crossed the street to the other corner and stood below the canopy of the Fox Theater. He could see through the front window of Stratton's, but didn't see her. He walked through the parking lot next to the restaurant and into the rear alley. He saw a public access door at the back. Had she seen him and used the restaurant to slip away? It had been a long while since he had been on a one-man tail, but he didn't think she had made him. He headed down the alley and went in the back door. Eleanor Wish was sitting alone in a row of wooden booths along the restaurant's right wall. Like any careful cop, she sat facing the front door, so she didn't see Bosch until he slid onto the bench across from her and picked up the menu she had already scanned and dropped on the table. He said, "Never been here. Anything good?"
"What is this?"
she said, surprise clearly showing on her face.
"I don't know. I thought you might want some company."
"Did you follow me? You followed me."
"At least I'm being upfront about it. You know, you made a mistake back at the office. You played it too cool. I walk in with the only lead you've had in 9 months, and you want to talk about liaisons and bullshit. Something wasn't right, but I couldn't figure out what. Now I know."
"What are you talking about?"
"Never mind. I don't want to know."
She made a move to slide out of the booth, but Bosch reached across the table and firmly put his hand on her wrist. Her skin was warm and moist from the walk over. She stopped and turned and smoked him with brown eyes so angry and hot they could have burned his name on a tombstone.
"Let go,"
she said, her voice tightly controlled, but carrying enough of an edge to suggest she could lose it. He let go.
"Don't leave, please."
She lingered a moment, and he worked quickly. He said, "It's all right. I understand the reasons for the whole thing, the cold reception back there, everything. I have to say, it actually was good work, what you did. I can't hold it against you."
"Bosch, listen to me. I don't know what you are talking about. I think..."
"I know you already knew about Meadows, the tunnels, the whole thing. You pulled his military files. You pulled mine. You probably pulled files on every rat that made it out of that place alive. There had to have been something in the Westland job that connected to the tunnels back there."
She looked at him for a long moment and was about to speak when a waitress approached with a pad and pencil.
"And for now, just one coffee, black, and an Evian. Thank you," Bosch said before Wish or the waitress could speak.
The waitress walked away, writing on the pad.
"I thought you were a cream and sugar cop,"
Wish said.
"Only when people try to guess what I am."
Her eyes seemed to soften then, but only a bit.
"Detective Bosch, look, I don't know how you know what you think you know, but I am not going to discuss the Westland case. It is exactly as I said at the Bureau. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I really am."
Bosch said, "I guess maybe I should resent it, but I don't. It was a logical step in the investigation. I would have done the same. You take anybody who fit the profile, tunnel rat, and sift them through the evidence."
"You're not a suspect, Bosch, okay? So drop it."
"I know I'm not a suspect."
He gave a short, forced burst of laughter.
"I was serving a suspension down in Mexico and can prove it. But you already know that. So for me, fine. I'll drop it. But I need what you have on Meadows. You pulled his files back in September. You must have done a workup on him. Surveillance, known associates, background, maybe... I bet you even pulled him in and talked to him. I need it all, now, today, not in 3-4 weeks when some liaison puts a stamp on it."
The waitress came back with the coffee and water. Wish pulled her glass close, but didn't drink.
"Detective Bosch, you are off the case. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be the one to tell you, but you're off. You go back to your office and you'll find out. We made a call after you left."
He was holding his coffee with two hands, elbows on the table. He carefully put the cup down on the saucer in case his hands began to shake.
"What did you do?"
Bosch asked.
"I'm sorry,"
Eleanor Wish said.
After you left, Rourke, the guy you shoved the picture in front of, he called the number on your card and talked to a Lieutenant Pounds. He told him about your visit today and suggested there was a conflict, you investigating a friend's death. He said some other things and...
What other things?
Look,